But thank you, Justin, and good morning, everyone. I am happy to invite you to join us in this conversation with Judge Carol Robb about how she's been using Bridges' ideas in her court. We have found that there's a lot of interest from the criminal justice system and judges in the Bridges' work. And in talking with Jody Farr and Terry Drewski Smith, and I can tell you from my own experience that we've been invited to speak with Supreme Court justices of various states. So we've been busy in California and in the Dakotas and in Minnesota and different places where we've talked with judges. And there's always an interest in the Bridges approach to these things. So this conversation, I hope, will be one of several. I think what's going to happen is judges like Judge Carol Robb will begin to use these ideas in their courtrooms and become and get better outcomes, and we'll all learn from them. And so if we have a call every quarter or so with a different judge, we can begin to sort of catalog the learning that's going on. So this is a growing community of practice that we have going on with the Bridges work. And of course, this topic is with the judges, but there's other topics that we will be doing these kind of recorded conversations on. As our body of knowledge expands, we just have to find to share information with everybody. So today is the first of a series of conversations with judges who use our work. And it's a real joy to have Judge Carol Robb on. And I'd like her just to say hello, and then I have a couple of other panelists that are going to talk with us, too, throughout the conversation. At the end, towards the end of our conversation, we'll open up for everyone to call in. But so, Judge Carol Robb, please say hello.
Well, good morning, everyone.
We, Judge Carol Robb and I were together, I think, was it last week at a Supreme Court training, or was it the week before? I've kind of lost track.
It was last week, Phil, yes.
So she was helping us there. We were doing a training of trainers for the Supreme Court of Ohio, and they have an initiative to create Bridges communities, and so we spent 3 days doing this there, too. So it's good to talk with you again. We have Kelly Richards. If you can say hello and tell us where you're from and what your interest is in Bridges and so on, we'd like to have you on the panel, too. So could you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. Good morning. My name is Kelly Richards. I have worked at the Public Defender's Office in Pensacola, Florida for over 25 years. I'm now still working as an indigent criminal defense attorney in Pensacola, and I've also been an ally involved with our local Bridges to Circles program, which began in March of this year.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sandy Kemp is from Nevada.
And like Phil said, my name is Sandy Kemp, and I am with the Friendly Circles Initiative as a coach, but also with the Lyon County Human Services as a case manager for those recently released from prison. We do getting ahead within circles, but we've got a great interest in the local judicial system. They would really like to order certain clients that they have to attend Getting Ahead classes.
Hey. Well, thanks for joining us. So that's the team. Unless we have Judge Goodman. I'd invited Judge Goodman to join us, and I didn't hear him sign in. And if you're out there, please unmute and join the conversation. But if you're not there, we'll go ahead. So Judge Carol Robb, could you introduce, tell us how you got involved in the Bridges work, and then take us through some of the things that you did in your court that made a difference in your community.
I'd be happy to, Phil. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be part of this telephone conference today. I know that our community has embraced Bridges, and we are seeing results from the initiatives that we have promoted in our community, and we're happy to share some of those results with you today. Actually, I first learned about Bridges. I was elected to the bench in November of 2005, and a friend of mine happens to be the director of our local community action agency. And she sent me a lovely congratulatory note, and attached to it was the book, Bridges Out of Poverty. I read the book, and as I read it, it just made a lot of sense to me, particularly with the clientele with which we deal in the municipal court system. At the same time, I was preparing a specialty docket, and I acknowledged that there's a lot of similarity between the success of the specialty docket and the Bridges concept, in that one of the driving forces in the success of a specialty docket is the relationship the defendant develops with the judge. And so when you go back to your lessons in Bridges and how relationship is the overriding force from people from generational poverty, you can see where some of these concepts easily fit into and address issues that we see in the court. After I read the book, I was invited by the Community Action Agency to attend a one-day training. The agency had brought Phil in to train their employees and employees of other agencies here in Columbiana County. They had a couple of empty seats, and so the director invited me and my staff to attend the one-day Bridges training. Now, let me pause for a moment and explain that my staff consists of one full-time probation officer and a part-time bailiff. We are in an Appalachian region here. Resources are very scarce, so we run a very lean machine. The three of us did attend the one-day Bridges training. And after we attended the Bridges training, I had an extended lunch meeting with my staff, and I challenged them to address every issue that persons who enter our court face. So what we literally did was we tracked a person. Let's say, for example, you have an individual who is picked up on a speeding ticket. They have the option to appear or the option to simply post a bond, sign the back of the ticket, mail it in, post the bond, and that's taken care of. Well, for middle class or upper income individuals, $107 isn't usually a big deal. You can usually come up with that within the 7 to 10 day time period. But people from generational poverty, we understand sometimes that's not so readily available. So what was commonly happening is these individuals would not post the bond. They would not appear at the hearing because they didn't have the money and they were afraid they would have to come up with the money immediately at that hearing. And so they were just kind of putting it on the back burner. So that would eventually result in a warrant being issued and their driver's license being suspended. These suspensions occur without any notice to the defendant. So they're unaware of a suspended driver's license until the next time they get picked up for a minor traffic incident. Maybe they're speeding or they drive through another stop sign. They get picked up on that violation. The officer does a check and discovers that they're also driving under a suspended driver's license. Now we have multiple problems and multiple counts that they're facing. So we could intervene and eliminate that obstacle. So what our court initiated was, after the bond time period has passed, a letter goes out to all those who were cited under a bondable offense, and they are advised that they have a period of time in which to pay this, or if they would like to make payment arrangements, they can appear at the court and enter a plea. Fines will be assessed, and then a payment plan will be developed for them. And what we have found by just issuing this simple letter is that there was an increase of 28% in payment on bondable cases, which means that 28% of the cases, there weren't warrants issued, there weren't suspended driver's licenses. The county was getting their fees and court costs, and persons were not having their driver's license suspended. Some of the other examples that we came across is using the overriding principle of relationships being the driving force from generational poverty. We now encourage the probation officers to immediately meet with the defendant after sentencing and once probation is set. And we encourage them to just briefly talk with them, meet with them, allow them to converse and develop a relationship with the probation officers. Now, this was a hard adjustment for us because we are so thinly staffed. But what we have discovered over a period of time is that once a relationship is established with the probation officer, then the defendants are more apt to take a proactive position when they start running into problems. For example, if they are ordered to do community service and they are given a period of time, say 60 days to perform 30 hours of community service, at the end, towards the end of that 60-day time period, if they don't have that community service completed, they are now contacting the probation officer and asking what they should do. They're taking a more proactive position in these matters. And the probation officer can give them direction on what actions they can take to prevent a probation violation action being filed against them. We also, again, we encourage the probation officers to meet with their defendants immediately after sentencing. But sometimes that's not possible. In the past, I would always set a time certain when they were to meet with the probation officer. I would order them to appear back here to meet with the probation officer, for example, next Tuesday at 3 o'clock. Well, what we were finding is many of these individuals weren't appearing before the probation officer on that designated date and time, which would result in warrants being issued. But thinking back to the agency time element, we decided to change our philosophies there and give them a time period in which to report to the probation officer. So now what we do, instead of setting a date and time certain, they are asked to return and meet with the probation officer before Friday at 4 o'clock. What we have found is, in Columbiana County, all of our main agencies are located in our county seat, where our municipal court is now located. Most likely these individuals will be within a mile of the court for agency time, sometime between the order and when they must appear to the probation officer. So when they are in the area meeting with agencies, they then simply come to the court. They may have to wait a period of time because we do have a busy schedule here at the court, but they are then given an opportunity to meet with the probation officer based upon their proximity to the court and other agency demands. This has literally eliminated our need to issue warrants for failure to appear and report to a probation officer. Another matter that we examined, it had been the prior practice of our court that once a warrant was issued for the arrest of a defendant, that the defendant was required to surrender to the Columbiana County Sheriff and then taken into custody and delivered to the court through the Sheriff's Department in the custody of the Sheriff. What we now permit the defendants to do is if they voluntarily surrender to the court, just report to the court, then we address their reason for failure to appear and determine whether or not they should be released on an OR bond or a surety bond or sometimes taken into custody until the matter can be addressed. But we no longer require them to surrender initially to the Columbiana County Sheriff based on that warrant. What that has done is it has freed up the sheriff and deputy time. It has freed up some many times unnecessarily used jail space because occasionally they'll surrender. The deputies aren't able to get to the court during the normal operating hours, and therefore they're held in custody until the next business day of the court. And it's pretty much eliminated that type of a situation.
Judge Robb,
mm-hmm.
You've given us, I think, three examples here of the kind of things that you've done. And I want to make sure the others can get in questions here too, but you know, I wonder what kind of, did you get any kind of resistance while you were beginning to employ these kind of ideas from any place in the community at all?
None at
all.
Or
were these things embraced just right off the bat?
They were embraced right off the bat. Our sheriff is delighted because his deputies are no longer being used for these type of activities.
Oh, can I just...
Yes?
Oh,
yes.
Hi, this is Shirley Paulson from the Community Action Partnership in Sandpoint, Idaho.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah,
just fine, thank you.
Thanks.
I'm so sorry we were late. We just got the phone number. I'm here with my Guiding Coalition Chair, Paul Grace. And good morning, everybody.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
You might, for the time being, mute your phone and by pushing star 6, and then later on when we open the floor for questions, you can come back in by hitting star 6 again.
Absolutely.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Welcome. To respond in more detail to the question that Phil posed, we have not faced any resistance by the community. The sheriff's department is pleased with the arrangement because it has freed up their personnel. They, because of budgetary restraints, have a skeleton crew, and when they can use their resources in a more productive manner, they are delighted to do so. The defendants are more apt to surrender themselves to the court than to the sheriff's department, and so we are more apt to get the case back on track and back into an active docket by handling it this way, so it increases the judicial efficiency of the court. So I have not had any negative feedback from the community at all.
It seems to me that the pieces that you picked up from the Bridges work in here were the idea of the importance of relationships and making relationships of mutual respect between a judge and the offender and between your staff and the offender. And so that relationship piece is the piece you picked up. And then you mentioned agency time, and that's the idea that people are so busy coming to the agencies, well, you just figured they'd be in town anyway. So you kind of spread out the time frame in which they could go and see the probation officer. So were there any other things that came from Bridges that contributed to these strategies?
I think those are the main points, Phil. We have implemented other uses here in our court. For example, the community service. You know, the persons from generational poverty, you know, are subject to predatory practices. And when I first took the bench here, the community embraced community service, has for many, many years. This is not a new concept to our community. However, when I took the bench, we were only giving them credit at $6 per hour for the community service value they gave back to the community. I sit in a court with one other judge, so I am not permitted to make policy changes without the cooperation of that other judge. He and I had some extensive conversations, and I got him up to $7 an hour, you know, having been on the bench for only a week or two. And after some further conversations, he finally conceded. And we are now giving credit of $10 per hour for community service activity. Now, you need to understand that community service in our community is a very valued service. If it was not for the community service provided through our municipal court, our county would not have a county fair. Our county would not have, most of the cities and townships and towns would not have parks in the condition that they are currently in. Many of our public cemeteries would not be properly maintained. Many of our public and community buildings would not be maintained. Our own courthouse, our municipal courthouse here, is maintained by community service personnel. We have, here in the courthouse, we have a part-time gentleman who is a maintenance/probation officer, and he oversees and directs community service individuals here at the court. And this is a valuable service that these individuals provide to our community. And in fairness to all, the rate of $10 per hour seemed justified. What we have found is that, number one, most of these individuals Their time has never been valued at $10 per hour, and so they have greater pride in the community service that they're rendering. They no longer feel as though they're being taken advantage of. We allow community service to be used not only to in lieu of jail time. For example, my philosophy when I sentence is I will issue a sentence. Maybe some of that sentence will be served in jail. The balance of it will be suspended, subject to certain terms of probation. My philosophy is if there is a suspended jail sentence, there must be some other payment for the community. And so I always order community service in lieu of jail. Now, once they complete that initial community service order, if they are not financially able to meet the responsibilities of fines, costs, and fees, we will grant them the opportunity to perform additional community service and give them credit against those fines, costs, and fees at the rate of $10 per hour. What we are finding is that people no longer just ignore their fines, costs, and fees because financially they have no ability to meet them. That reduces the number of probable causes or contempts that we must file and process through the courts. And it also gives them an opportunity to work it off in a dignified manner, giving back to the community. Another point in the way the court functioned, another deficiency that we found, was electronically monitored house arrest. Now, again, this is not a new concept. It's been used by our court and many throughout the country for an extended period of time. But from a practical standpoint, this was a luxury only available to those who were able to afford it because there is a cost related to electronically monitored house arrest. We call it EMHA. Our court does not own any EMHA equipment. We do not have the staff to monitor it, nor do we have the investment dollars to buy the equipment or to pay for the satellite use. So our court has always used a private providers or provider to provide that service to the court. So what I did was I contacted our primary private provider and we negotiated an arrangement whereby that private provider will make available to our county up to 4 bracelets at any time to be used by indigent defendants. They charge only the cost of the satellite fees that they must pay and the cost of the bracelet itself. It's far less expensive than any other arrangement I could find available to my county. Once I had an arrangement like that with my provider, my private provider, I then spoke with the county commissioners and explained to them that if they gave me a limited budget, I could save them tens of thousands of dollars a year. Now again, our community is somewhat unique in that our jail is owned by the county, but it is not operated by our county sheriff. Our jail is operated under a private contract with a private company. That private company charges our county on a per diem basis for each defendant held. And the current rate is approximately $59. It goes up every year, but it's around $59 and some cents. So every day that I can keep somebody out of our county jail, I can save my county approximately $60 plus medical expenses. Because whenever a defendant is incarcerated, all forms of medical coverage is not available, and the medical expenses of that defendant falls upon the general fund of the county. So by the county commissioners allocating a budget of $10,000 to me to use electronically monitored house arrest for indigent defendants. Now these, of course, would be defendants who are not a threat to the community or to themselves. You know, we're concerned for public safety, and that is our overriding obligation here. We're not talking about somebody that is a threat to the community, but many defendants that we see in the municipal court system are nonviolent offenders, but they must, for whatever reason, be incarcerated. By doing the electronically monitored house arrest, I can make that service available to indigent defendants at no cost to them and an extremely reduced cost for the county. Now, we have been doing this for, we're concluding our second calendar year. But in 2008, by doing this electronically monitored house arrest project in lieu of incarceration, I was able to save the county $65,000 in jail fees and an undeterminable amount of money for medical expenses for indigent defendants. By doing this, we were able to level the playing field and give indigent defendants the same options and opportunities that persons from middle and upper classes enjoy for years. And we were able to do so in a way that saves the county a large amount of money.
Those are great results, and the kind of thing that others are going to want to read about. And if I could just say here that there's a written document that people can download from our website. So for those of you that are beginning to hear things that you like, you can go to the AHA Process website, then go to Community Programs, and from there to Research Results. And at the bottom of the first page, you're going to see the information that Judge Robb has been talking about that she wrote up in a short summary. So that's available to you in writing.
Thank you.
Let me just throw this open for questions, and maybe Kelly or Sandy have questions, and then we'll come back and hear about some more things that you've done.
This is Kelly. I don't have any questions right now, but it certainly sounds wonderful, and I would love to be able to present this kind of information to our community.
And this is Sandy. Everything sounds absolutely wonderful, and I don't have any questions yet.
Okay. Well, the others can email in if they have questions that they want to pose. They can send them to Justin, and Justin will pass them on to me. But Judge Robb, can you do you have more examples of what you've done? And
I do.
Go on.
I do. I'm not sure how other states handle suspended driver's license, but let me kind of give you a little bit of background with the state of Ohio. In the state of Ohio, many times people get entwined in the Bureau of Motor Vehicles unknowingly. As I talked about a little earlier, sometimes an individual will be stopped for just a minor traffic offense because of finances. They don't meet that initial obligation. Before they know it, there's a warrant block on their license. Their license is suspended. They're not even aware of that. They then get picked up again on a minor violation only to discover that they have a suspended driver's license. Meanwhile, you know, points are adding up against their license. They have to pay a reinstatement fee every time there's an activity, every time there's a suspension issued by the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. So now they go to the first court. They pay the court costs and the fines and everything. Yes, that court tells them, no problem, we've released the warrant block on your driver's license, but they forget to go to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles and pay what is now a $25 reinstatement fee. So they're still driving under suspension. So to make a long story short, people very unknowingly can become extremely entwined in the bureaucracy of the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. Some of the courts in our communities have literally hired probation officers or assistants to come in and go online and mentor people through the BMV process. I don't have that luxury. I don't have a budget for that, and I don't have a luxury for that. So what we have done is, first of all, we've made arrangements to the local administrative office of the Bureau of Motor Vehicles to have direct online access. So both me and my probation officer, as well as my BLA, can go online, and we can access the driving records of the individuals, and we can also, our Bureau of Motor Vehicles has a special screen that brings up exactly what they need to do to become reinstated. So we are online for that, and we try to make that available to the defendant as best we can. But to take that one step further, I contacted the administrative office of our region for the Bureau of Motor Vehicles and asked if they would be willing to come down to our community and meet with defendants to
on a face-to-face basis and answer their questions and do what needs to be done or give them the direction that they need in order to become valid. We have been doing this now for about 2 years, and I think we have handled, I think we've had about 5 or 6 sessions. Originally, we were trying to offer it on a quarterly basis because of state budget cutbacks. The Bureau of Motor Vehicles became a little resistant on the travel expense, even though it's only a 20-mile trip. They had a blanket suspension of all travel expenses. But because they were having such wonderful results from our court, they have exempted us out of it. So they come down about 2 to 3 times a year. We advertise it in our local paper. We let it known throughout the Bar Association. So if the attorneys have clients who are really struggling with license problems, they call the court, the clerk's office at our court, and they set an appointment with the Bureau of Motor Vehicles for that day. They come into the court, they meet with the supervisor, they send the district supervisor down for these sessions, and she meets on a one-to-one basis with these individuals. And we have had approximately 10% of those individuals leave the courthouse that day with a valid license. The other 90% have a clear understanding of what they need to do in order to become valid. Again, transportation is a big issue in our county, so it's been a tremendous service for people from generational poverty because the district office, which is where all this is handled, is in Youngstown, and that's approximately 20 to 30 miles away based upon your location within our county. So to bring the supervisors to our county and make the court facility available to them has been a great service to our community. I noticed that when some of you introduced yourselves earlier, many of you are working with Getting Ahead, and our community has a Getting Ahead initiative. It began approximately 2 years ago, and let me give you just a little bit of community background here. Bridges was introduced to Columbiana County, Ohio, approximately 7 or 8 years ago through our agency. The Department of Job and Family Services, their director, found Bridges, felt that it was an appropriate way to address these issues, and made arrangements through Kent State University to bring Bridges to the agency. So when I took the bench and became aware of Bridges, the foundation was already laid in our community from an agency standpoint. But the problem that the initiative was having was breaking out of the agency shell and getting into the general populace and particularly into the private business sector. And that is really where the court has been very influential. When I first took the training by Phil in San Diego, California, that would have been in the fall of 2006, our Supreme Court made a grant available to me and paid all of my expenses to go and obtain the train the trainer. During that conference, Phil made me aware of the extent in which our community was already committed to Bridges and was kind enough to provide me with the contact information. I wanted to come back and offer Getting Ahead to defendants in my court. The problem was I had no facilitators and no funds in which to accomplish that. So my initial contact was with Kent State University and Youngstown State University, both of which are licensed trainers for AHA process, and both of which have extensive background in Bridges training as well as Getting Ahead facilitating. And they were extremely receptive and eager to participate in what I wanted to do. Unfortunately, they also had no money. So I asked who did, and they said that usually Department of Job and Family Services, Community Action Agency, and OneStop would have grants available to them. So I invited these directors to the table. And one nice thing about this is usually when you get an invitation from a judge, people show up at meetings. And that's what I found to occur here. So at the next meeting with the directors of these agencies sitting around the table with these experienced facilitators, then they knew one another. This was an introduction to them. But I posed the question to them or the challenge to them, how can we offer getting ahead defendants from our court? The wonderful part about when you pose an issue and you have policymakers around the table, solutions come about. And as a result of open conversation, our Department of Job and Family Services offered to write a grant for a, we called it an open enrollment style of getting ahead. And the facilitation was provided through Kent State University. We offered the getting ahead for the physical year 2007-2008, for the fiscal year 2008-2009, through TANF grant through the Department of Job and Family Services. Now, I wasn't the only one referring persons to the getting ahead. Each one of these fiscal years, I sent about 20 defendants there. Other individuals participated in the getting ahead training. They trained approximately 70 to 75 individuals each year in the getting ahead program. In the fiscal year, the current fiscal year, 2009 and 2010, the TANF funds have dried up. They've become less available. So we use a stimulus grant through OneStop to provide for the getting ahead training. Unfortunately, those funds are not coming through on a timely manner. So we were only able to offer two getting ahead classes, and we're now waiting for OneStop to have additional funding available.
Judge Robb, this is Sandy from Nevada.
Yes, Sandy.
I'm curious to know, what is the process for your selection of the defendants that you order to getting ahead?
Well, first of all, I'm reluctant to mandate it as a term of probation. I'm very selective on who I refer to the Getting Ahead program for multiple reasons. First of all, we're a county with limited resources, and I don't want to waste them on individuals that have no desire to change. Secondly, you know, the Getting Ahead initiative is just that. It is a individual from generational poverty who has the desire to expand their resources and explore the opportunity to move into middle class. There are some people from generational poverty that have no desire to make that change. So, you know, this is an individual decision, and they must have a commitment to this before I will refer them to the Getting Ahead program. I have never made participation in Getting Ahead a term of probation. But when I do identify an individual that I think would benefit from the initiative, I give them the information, I suggest to them that they make contact, and then usually when they report back through probation, we try to keep track on whether or not they did in fact get into the Getting Ahead program, whether or not they were able to complete that program. I can tell you that these few that have been able to enter the program and complete the program say that it is an extremely worthwhile experience. It empowers them in a way that they have seldom been empowered before. And I would like to encourage everybody, if you ever have the opportunity to attend a Getting Ahead graduation ceremony, do so for multiple reasons. First of all, when you enter the room, you will be entering a room full of more hope than you have probably had surrounding you in a very long time. And secondly, when you sit and you listen to the testimonies and the stories of these individuals and how this process has impacted their life and impacted their viewpoint, this is the way that you get personal testimonies to take it to your community and make it more real.
So you do not actually order any defendants to attend Getting Ahead?
I do not. I make recommendations, and sometimes, and I'll tell you why. Number one, our funding is so limited here that if I ordered it, chances, you know, there's a very strong likelihood that they're not going to get into the program because it's limited, it's offered on such a limited basis. So for me to order them into something that they may not be able to get into is setting them up for failure. Okay?
Okay.
Secondly, not everybody is going to be receptive to this. And not everybody is going to want to change. And so I don't think you can make it a blanket requirement throughout your court. Now, what I hope to do is our Supreme Court is very progressive with Bridges. As I mentioned before, they paid through a grant for me to attend the Train the Trainer. They paid through a grant for me to attend the Circle training. I was the first judge, I believe, in our state in which they offered that opportunity. Since that time, they have done so for other judges in our state. They have a very comprehensive plan on how Bridges is going to be implemented throughout the judicial system, the criminal justice system in our state. And as part of that plan, they have offered Bridges training, one-day Bridges training, throughout the state over the last few months. So courts and organizations affiliated with the court system were encouraged to send persons to the one-day Bridges training. I know our community sent several people to that training, one of them being one of our county commissioners. Then our Supreme Court also recently sponsored, as Phil just alluded to a few moments ago, the Train the Trainer. They offer the four-day training to employees of the court or member organizations of the court. So, for example, with my court having such a slim staff, it didn't make good sense for me to send my one probation officer with the intent of training people within the court system because there's nobody else to train. All of our people here have already been trained in Bridges, and it's available through other agencies on a periodic basis enough that I didn't need to put one of my my probation officer through Train the Trainer. But we had member organizations within our community that sent employees to the Train the Trainer being offered by the Supreme Court. So that our steering committee now, through their member organizations, we have five new Bridges trainers that can provide training to our future volunteers, our future employees, and employers, the private sector that we have made contact with and we have the attention of at this point in time. Let me take just a moment here. About a year ago, through the ad hoc steering committee that I referenced earlier, remember I talked about how I met with Kent State, Youngstown State. They then suggested we meet with the Department of Job and Family Services, One Stop and Community Action Agency director. We met with them. From there, it grew into an ad hoc steering committee. And that steering committee's objective was to bring the Bridges from the agency area of our community into the private sector. And as part of that, I had numerous speaking engagements when I went out and I spoke to Lions and Rotary and Roratan and any organization, teachers organizations, any organization that wanted to hear about Bridges. We also planned a 2.5-day Bridges training. We brought Phil into our community in October of 2008. He came in on a Wednesday late in the afternoon and met with key persons from our ad hoc committee to discuss what we were doing within our community. And then on Thursday, he offered an all-day training, and the persons in attendance at that Bridges one-day training were new employees of some of our agencies. There were a few such individuals present. But mostly, they were volunteers. These are private citizens who, through the public speaking engagement, had expressed an interest in being involved in this community's initiative. So we offered them this training free with Phil DeVault. That night, then, we had a special dinner meeting with chief executive officers from our community. And we pulled in CEOs from all segments of our community, both the southern part and the northern part of our county. And I think we had, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10 or something like that, businessmen there having dinner with Phil. And Phil was able, in a very concise manner, to describe to them the basic premises of Bridges and how it impacts the private sector, the business town, the employer. And as a result of that, the following day, we then offered a one-day Bridges training for the private employer. We had 11 private employers attend that Bridges training. Phil presented in the morning, and in the afternoon, we had a representative from Cascade Engineering who could come in and directly speak to how the Bridges concepts were incorporated within their business. As a result of those efforts, we then dissolved our ad hoc committee because we now knew we had enough commitment from the private sector, from the business sector, private business sector, and of course from the agency, that we could support a community-wide Bridges initiative. So that ad hoc committee was dissolved and a formal Bridges steering committee was formed. That formal Bridges steering committee has now incorporated, become a nonprofit corporation. There is pending a 501c application with the Internal Revenue Service. And we have just recently written a grant, and we're hoping to see one of 6 grants being offered through the state of Ohio. We as a community are at the point where we need a full-time coordinator to direct our efforts. Everything thus far has been done by volunteers. Persons, directors from various agencies, myself, people who have full-time careers outside of the Bridges arena who have been donating our time and our efforts in order to spearhead this initiative. And if somebody used the example of Boy Scouts, and I think that's a very good example. You know, Boy Scouts is a volunteer organization, but at the top of the pyramid where the policies are being made and the directives are being made, those they do have a paid staff. And we are at that point where we need that kind of directive and that full-time commitment by a person with drive and initiative that will take us from here and direct us on. As a result of our private employers being trained on that Friday, we've already had one private employer step forward and say that when we have our getting ahead up and running on a more consistent basis, that he will give preferential hiring treatment to our getting ahead graduates. We have another private employer who is in the southern part of the county who has taken the Bridges concept and woven it throughout his entire business entity, and he has multiple business entities. So I keep telling Phil that we have a business down in the southern part of Pontiana County that's going to be his next Cascade Engineering.
Wow. That, Judge Rob, thanks so much. This is a really, really sort of inspiring kind of story that I think other people can take back to their communities and share with them. And really appreciate your sharing this much with us. I wonder if, at this point, Justin, if we can open the phone lines and people can comment or ask questions. We can move into that phase of this now.
Okay, and we certainly can. I actually didn't have to use the administrative mute, so anyone who'd like to speak can simply hit *6 and unmute their line. I did have one question email that just came in, and it was from Kathy Mueller, and she just could not locate the resource that you referenced on the website and was wondering if you could tell her again where that was.
Okay.
But yes, yeah, certainly anyone who would like to comment or discuss just needs to unmute their lines by hitting *6, and we can continue.
Well, while you're all reaching for your phones, let me give you directions again on how to get to the paper that was written by Judge Rob. You will go to ahaprocess.com. From there, you will go to the Bridges icon. It's the word bridges and out of poverty is above it. It's in the top left-hand corner of the AHA Process website. Click on that, and it will take you to the Bridges homepage. From there, you will go to Community Programs, and from there to Research Results. And if you just wrote those words down, AHA Process website, the icon for Bridges, Community Programs, and next would be, as you're working your way down, would be Research Results. And it's, you can find it there at the bottom of that page.
Actually, Phil, on the new design of our website, the Research Results is its own tab. So there's a gray toolbar at the top, and they can simply click on Research Results and Bridges Community.
Okay. So they would go to the Research Results, and then there's a drop down between schools and community. Is that the way it works?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Justin.
And this is Sandy from Nevada. I was actually just on there, and for some reason it's not allowing you to click on the research results. So I don't know if that's a glitch on your end. I do have a couple more questions, that's Rob, regarding getting ahead. How would you measure the effectiveness? And I know there's probably no statistics per se, but effectiveness of the getting ahead from your recommendations. Would you say that you have most of the ones that you recommend attend getting ahead go to getting ahead, or?
I would say that probably, I would say about half of them actually get into the program, and I would say probably of those half, about 80% of those completed.
So when you say half get into the program, is that more of there's not enough room for them, or?
There's not enough room.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. And one more. Are you aware, how long are the classes that Kent State does for you? Are they 16 weeks? Do you make that a weekly thing, or is it done in the two-day period?
What they have been doing when they were offering the TANF training under the TANF grant, they were offering a 30-hour getting ahead program. I hate to use the word program. It was 30 hours for them to complete the getting ahead process. And they would do it on a weekly basis, but each time the individual spent 3 hours in the session. So they actually offered 10 sessions. It was 3 hours per session. They move the locations around. Our county covers a large geographic area, and transportation is an issue because we have no public transportation per se. The only public transportation we have is a very limited, they call it CART. It's offered through our community action agency. It's very low cost, but it has limited operating hours and limited accessibility. So because of that, they offered, for example, they usually offer 4 to 5 getting ahead opportunities in a fiscal year. And what they would do is they would have one perhaps in the northern part of the county for 10 weeks, one down the southern part of the county for 10 weeks, one in the middle part of the county for 10 weeks. And then based upon where the greatest demand was, the fourth one might be, you know, either one of those three locations. They also limited the number of weeks because of the transportation issues and the idea that, you know, when you think of the time sequence from generational poverty, they don't think futuristic. If you can make it a more condensed time period, the likelihood of completion increases, and that's what Kent State has indicated to us. What we do to try to measure the effectiveness of the Getting Ahead program, and actually we just started that this year when the Getting Ahead was being funded through the stimulus money, we were requiring, we created a basic questionnaire, and we were requiring that all who entered the Getting Ahead program complete that questionnaire pre-Getting Ahead. And then they had to complete the same questionnaire immediately upon graduation from Getting Ahead. Now, what we're hoping is the two classes that took it under the stimulus grant that have already been completed, we are hoping that in about 6 months after their graduation, that contact will be made with them again and they complete again the same question so that data can begin to be collected.
Thank you.
We're open for more questions or comments.
Hi, Bill, this is Melissa in Oklahoma.
Hi.
Hi, I have a, sorry, my voice just kind of cracked. I have a question for the judge. We did Getting Ahead last night, and I have an individual that got assigned to drug court, and he's very grateful for that. He works at a minimum wage factory, and one of his concerns is that it's going to cost him $200 a month, but one of the issues is that he has to commit 3 appointments a week that are during the day, which takes away from his ability to work, so that during that time he doesn't get paid. I'm just curious as to what kind of things you all have done to help out in a situation like that.
Well, for example, we do not have, with the exception of our specialty docket, we do not have reporting probation. Our probation terms are generally non-reporting. And we do that, it's basically an economic decision. We do not have the staff or the enough hours in the day for my probation officer to have reporting probation. His caseload runs around 500 to 550 defendants. So you can appreciate that there is no way he could manage that kind of caseload if it was a reporting type of probation. Now, some courts have offered evening hours to address those issues. I know some courts in the state who, you know, will have the court open maybe 1 or 2 evenings a week until 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening so that persons such as you described would have the ability to come in and meet with the probation officer and transact business with court after traditional business hours. Our court hasn't done that for a couple of reasons. First of all, there was a similar program initiated in our common pleas court about 3 years ago. It was offered, and no one ever took advantage of it. The primary reason I would have to guess, there's been no research on this, but I think one of the primary reasons, again, goes back to transportation.
Yes, this individual doesn't have transportation either, but he's certainly very committed. He's a great participant in Getting Ahead, and we're just starting circles, and so they've written this up to go to the Big View, but it certainly helps to hear what kinds of solutions others across the country have come up with. So I really appreciate your feedback on that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I can tell you that many of our probationers have contact just by way of telephone with our probation officer. You know, they run into a problem or they have an issue, and they will simply call the probation officer. Our probation officer, of course, has voicemail abilities. You know, they leave a telephone number where they can be reached. And our rules in the court is the probation officer must return the call within 24 hours.
Another good idea.
It occurs to me that the question that you raised about the situation with your Getting Ahead person in Oklahoma, I think that when your judge gets a chance to hear some of the bridge's ideas, that maybe the judge will have sort of a change in mindset about that kind of requirement. I mean, maybe he's locked into it or she is locked into that kind of a process, but my guess is that there are options, and those would rest on the mindset and thinking of the judge. So that's what I think the value is of having judges who are using our work share their insights and strategies and ideas. and to do it in a way that other judges can hear it. Judge Robb, I didn't hear you mention this today. Maybe you did, and I missed it. But I know that when you're putting together these kind of strategies, you have sort of a one thing to measure all the strategies against. And that is, I think, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it has to do with it jeopardizing the integrity of the court.
That's correct. And I don't know that I've mentioned that, but I'm glad you brought that to my attention, Phil. Going back to my initial meeting with my staff after we had all completed our one-day Bridges Out of Poverty training, when I posed to them the challenge, this is the way I posed it to them. If you were from generational poverty and you were entering our judicial system, what barriers would you face and how can we eliminate those barriers without jeopardizing the integrity of the court? You know, we have a responsibility here to maintain the integrity of the judicial system. And so that is a test that we use. Whatever policy changes we may make cannot jeopardize the integrity of the court or the integrity of the justice system.
We'll take another comment or call, question.
Hi, this is Kathy from Finley.
Hi, Kathy.
I have a question on your community service program. You said you have a coordinator that handles all that. Did you have any problems securing jobs for them? How many people participate in it? Is it a well-used program?
All right. Basically, that is just one of the responsibilities of my probation officer. We do not have a community service coordinator. That is not a separate position in our court. There are many courts that have that luxury. I don't have that kind of luxury. The way we handle community service is my probation officer has a list of agencies, nonprofit organizations, or community activities that are receptive to accepting defendants to do community service. We do not provide direct supervision. The agency that requests participation in the community service program must provide the direct supervision. And the assignment of community service is based primarily upon the working hours of the defendant, if they are employed outside of the home, transportation needs or requirements of the defendant, and geography. As I said, our county is a large geographic area, so from a practical standpoint, we try not to run one person, you know, a defendant from one end of the county to the other to do community service. And we have, in each geographic area, we have lists of community service opportunities. Many of the agencies that use the community service workers are very good about letting us know when they're having work days. For example, the American Legion. We have a very active American Legion in the northern part of our county, and they have a lovely facility. They've got a large yard area there. So in the spring particularly, when they're going to be doing a lot of preparation work, they have soccer fields there that they make available to the youth sports. And I mean, it's a pretty good-sized facility. Well, it takes a lot of effort to maintain that. And so they will set up work days, and they'll let our probation officers know that on certain Saturdays they're intending to have work days, and then our probation officers are able to advise defendants that they have that opportunity to complete their community service at that particular location. Now, let me give you an example for that example. Let's say that they decide to work at the American Legion, and the assignment that day is going to be a lot of mowing and weed whacking. If they bring their own equipment, if they bring their own weed whacker, or if they bring their own lawnmower and provide the gas that's needed for it, then we give them extra community service credit.
Okay.
Hmm.
But no real dollars actually change hands.
No.
Correct?
No real dollars change hands. They do the community service for one of two reasons. They're either doing the community service in lieu of doing jail time, because that's just my philosophy, and the other judge in our court has a very similar philosophy. We simply believe that if we suspend a jail sentence, there must be some other way of giving back to the community. And that other way that we've acknowledged is community service. So they're either doing their community service in lieu of a suspended jail sentence, or they are doing community service because there's been a determination that the payment of costs and fines would deprive them and their family from necessities of life, and therefore they are eligible to do community service at the rate of $10 per hour to be applied to costs, fines, and fees.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Judge Rob, this is Kelly in Pensacola. I was able to print out your paper from the website, and I want to thank you for your ideas, and I look forward to presenting these to our administrative judge, and hopefully we can get the judges in our county here to come up with some plan to implement some of the bridges concepts. We have a very poor county. We have transportation issues for my clients, and they are often set up for failure. And so I just want to thank you very much for your ideas, and I think, you know, the not jeopardizing the integrity of the court, but allowing people from generational poverty to do other things to, work off their punishment are certainly wonderful ideas. And I look forward to presenting them to our administrative judge. Thank you.
One footnote on the community service, another benefit from that is we have had individuals who have used their community service experience as references for jobs. And we have actually had, three or four people obtain employment based upon the references. So in other words, for example, let's say you have a gentleman who goes out to the American Legion and he's put under the supervision of Joe. And Joe notes that he's a hard worker. He's there when he's supposed to be there. He doesn't take too long a break. He works an entire 8 hours that they've set aside for that day. And after he's completed his community service and Joe signs off for the defendant, Joe might say to him, you know, if you ever need a reference, I can vouch for your good work ethic. And so they will write letters of recommendation. And this is very important to persons from generational poverty because, as you know, many of them churn through jobs. It's not that they can't get jobs. They just sometimes have a hard time keeping jobs. And so, you know, if they go and just give a prior employment history, that may not be real conducive to a new employer. But a letter of recommendation from Joe at the American Legion saying that this is a gentleman or a lady with good work ethic, that's helped a couple of people get employment.
Hi, this is Bev in Findlay, Ohio. I have a question. You were talking about the Supreme Court of Ohio being involved in the endorsement of this process. Can you tell me, is there any documentation that is available that says that the Supreme Court is supporting Bridges?
Let me give you a contact name there. Her name is Attorney Melissa Knopf. Melissa is the coordinator of specialty dockets for the Ohio Supreme Court, and she has been very instrumental in developing this 4 or 5 year plan that's been adopted by the Supreme Court. And she would be a person that you would want to contact and get information from.
Is it possible for you to spell her last name for us, please?
Certainly. It's K-N-O-P-P, and the 800 number to the Supreme Court is 1-800-826-9010, and ask for Melissa Knopf. She'll be able to give you a copy of the long-range plan that's been developed by the Supreme Court.
Thank you. I was also wondering, you're talking about a demographic and working with county governments in your particular area. do you have any large city where you'd actually have to be working with city and county in some way?
Within our court system, our county is basically divided into two jurisdictions for our court level. So I only have to, no, I don't have to deal with any particular city. The city of Salem is within my jurisdiction. The city solicitor comes down to hear cases under the Salem City Code. The southern part of our county has the city of East Liverpool, and it also has two adjoining townships, Liverpool Township and St. Clair Township. So there might be a little more of a distinction because that is primarily a inner city municipal court serving also some municipal jurisdictions. But no, we really don't have multiple agencies or
local government
to deal with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I could tell the caller from Findlay that there were, at the recent training of trainers that the judge and I worked on last week, there wasn't anyone from Hancock County.
There was not?
No, and I'm sure they were, it was available in the sense that we did trainings all over the state in preparation for this four-day sort of trainer certification. And apparently no one took them up on it. The other question you might ask Melissa Knopp is whether or not there is a specialty docket, which would be a problem-solving court like a drug court or a mental health court in your county, because that's one thing that she's trying to start. And drug courts and specialty dockets are wonderful because they have these ideas that just are perfectly consistent with Bridges, and that is the idea that it's all about relationships. So now you have a relationship with a judge. You're in a drug court, and you have a relationship with a judge, and you see that person every week or every other week, and that goes on for a long time. And you have a support of a treatment team working with you. So it's support for transition over time based on relationships. And Melissa Knopp is a big driving force behind the Bridges work that's being done in the courts in Ohio.
So this invitation was sent out to the Hancock County judges, is that what you're saying, the one where no one showed up, or who was this invitation specifically to?
Well, we've been doing trainings, that is to say the Supreme Court has been setting up trainings, and we've done them in different parts of the state over the last number of years. And you could have had people who attended those. I'm just saying that at this particular event, there was no one there. You might have had some people there that went to the earlier one-day workshops.
Do you think Melissa would also know the history of who may have attended from Hancock County?
Well, we're getting into some real details here, but
sorry.
There's a judicial college that does trainings. There's specialty dockets that does training, and there's family court. Judge Rob, am I right, and the family and children courts. And so she wouldn't know about the trainings necessarily in the other sectors, but she would know about trainings done specialty docket.
All right, thank you so much.
Sure. Well, I'm not hearing any more callers. So, Judge Rob, let me thank you once again. It's just amazing to me, and I'm sure the listeners feel the same way, how much you've gotten done on a shoestring budget. You don't have much money there. It's a pretty poor county, and yet you've had a tremendous impact. And I know that you've been the driving force in your community for these things, and you are the example in Ohio. You're the champion. So I want to thank you for sharing your learning with us and the expertise that you've acquired in working with people in poverty. So thank you very much. I'd like to thank the panel for joining us and asking and posing questions. And for all of you that were listening in, I hope this has been helpful to you. This recording will be available on our website, and people you can encourage your judges to, or anyone else that you think should hear this, to go to the website and listen in.
Phil, actually, these are made available in our monthly newsletters, so if they would like to receive them, they likely already do if they're on the call, because that's where the invitation was sent also. But if they just go to our website and click on the Receive Our Newsletter, which is on the right-hand side of the homepage, and then they just put their email address in, and they'll receive it when it goes out next month.
Great. Okay, well, thank you, everyone, and have a good holiday. Bye-bye.
Thank you.